Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Forum, where science comes to socialize. Glad you could join us here at the Institute on Science for Global Policies podcast. I'm Cleo, and of course I have here with me Aubrey and Daniela.
Hey guys, it's Aubrey here. Thanks for tuning in. Today we have an episode for you on infectious disease, but we'll be including in our conversation some factors you might not have previously associated with this topic.
But first, you know we have to do our usual social media spiel. Make sure you hit us up with any questions or comments on our Twitter. You can find us at ISGP Forum.
Or, if you prefer Facebook, find us by searching for ISGP's The Forum.
Leave a comment, send a message, give us a like, retweet us, or just say hi. We're really down for any of it.
Okay, so back to the topic at hand. The debate we'll be discussing today focused on a policy position paper written by Dr. David Fisman, an associate professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. His paper was titled, Bugs and Bucks, Infectious Disease Persistence is a Matter of Economics, and it was presented at the conference, Emerging and Persistent Infectious Disease, Focus on Prevention, held from June 5th to 8th, 2011 in San Diego, California.
The paper covered a range of topics relevant to the role economics plays in the realm of infectious disease.
More specifically, though, the debate focuses on the United States and how mathematical modeling in particular can be an important tool for researchers and policymakers seeking to address infectious disease problems.
And today, we won't only cover some matters of economics in the realm of infectious disease, but we'll also touch on sociobehavioral responses and their implications for the topic as a whole.
See, I told you we'd be taking a different angle with this today. Get excited, people.
Ultimately, in this episode, we hope to get you thinking about how we can start developing solutions to better track, understand, prevent, and conceptualize infectious disease spread.
So first, let's start with this idea of mathematical modeling and how it fits into the topic of infectious disease.
Great idea, because to be honest, those two sounded mutually exclusive to me.
Oh, really? Come on.
I mean, on first thought.
Nah, I'm totally just kidding. Let's make that connection a little more explicit, because it really isn't that intuitive.
And it's interesting that you pointed it out, Cleo, because Dr. Fisman and the debaters discussed at length how mathematical models really aren't as involved as they should be in the process of researching infectious disease. So it makes sense that you wouldn't inherently see these two ideas fitting together.
But I guess hopefully after this episode, their relationship will make much more sense to everyone. The debaters argued that in the study of infectious diseases, mathematical models are valuable tools for four main reasons. Number one, they can help us understand a disease's scientific basis.
Two, they can help predict how the diseases spread.
Three, they're useful for demonstrating the impact of interventions that seek to stop the spread of infectious diseases.
And finally, number four, they can aid in the communication of complex concepts among scientists, policymakers, and the public. With this point, the debaters were envisioning communication through illustrative charts and diagrams, not the weird mathematical codes that immediately popped into my head, but anyway.
As you may have guessed, better incorporating mathematical models is no easy task to complete. There are definitely a few kinks to work out.
For starters, models can sometimes be misinterpreted as offering a clear vision into the future. But this crystal ball idea is pretty misleading, and we can't move forward assuming that a model will be able to predict what will occur with absolute confidence.
Exactly. The practical application of models to real-world scenarios is admittedly very limited by the model's inability to provide wholesome assurances.
At this point, you may be thinking, okay, so why use models at all? But despite the drawbacks and inherent imperfections of modeling, the debaters argued that they can nevertheless be effective tools for managing risk and uncertainty. And this is in the context of infectious disease, but I feel compelled to mention that if this modeling topic is of interest to you, definitely check out episode 15 of The Forum, called Lost in Translation, which discusses similar challenges associated with modeling of climate change.
That's actually a great point, Cleo. But anyway, the key to making the most of modeling, did you catch my alliteration there? So on point. Anyway, the key to making the most of modeling is to produce quality models and use them properly. But there was some disagreement among the debaters as to just how this is done.
For instance, while some may argue that these models are too complicated to be useful to lay audiences, others contend that models and their implications can be conveyed with varying degrees of complexity, so they're somewhat customizable when it comes to different audiences.
And these varying levels of complexity can also involve things like analogies and illustrations that can be used to distill the outcomes of models. This may make something complicated and confusing much more comprehensible for non-experts.
We do have to keep in mind, though, that sometimes all you really need is simple math. I'm talking basic addition and subtraction here, people. And this is to understand most models, including some that are relevant to infectious disease.
That's probably true, but I'm going to be honest here with you. Simple math has been known to trip me up most of the time. I see numbers and my brain freezes, so I'll take the analogies and illustrations. Please and thank you.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Minimal numbers for me, please.
You two are so ridiculous. But moving on, there's considerable debate regarding the extent to which mathematical models are currently being used in infectious disease research and public health efforts.
Yeah, it seemed that even our debaters were pretty split when it came to figuring this out. Some argue that these models are regarded as exotic or unusual, not widely available, and rarely taken into account in public health decisions.
At the same time, though, there were others who contended that mathematical model usage is actually quite common. If I'm being honest, it's weird to me that we don't know just how widely they're used, or at least that debaters couldn't agree how widely they're used, but, you know, whatever, there you have it.
I guess one of the few things that we can definitively say about this matter is that the use of mathematical models varies across fields of study and within the research and decision-making processes of some countries.
Agreed. Something we need to consider, though, if we want to increase the uptake of mathematical models for use in infectious disease research, is the difficulty in ensuring accuracy of the results.
And thus, the difficulty in ensuring that policymakers will actually use the models when making major decisions.
The debaters all agreed that in order to better establish confidence in mathematical models, it's absolutely necessary to develop a robust system for peer review and validation of said models, as well as set guidelines and share best practices among the modelers. Hey, you know what would be super meta? If we had models model the models. You know, I mean, I'm envisioning fashion models walking a laptop down a runway, and the laptop portrays some vivid graph, and the photographers just snap away.
I love that. Wait, what if the clothes the models were wearing had the graphs printed on them? That would take the term fashion model to a whole new level.
Oh, yes.
Okay, now you two are being ridiculous.
I mean, we do talk all the time about how to get the public more interested in science issues. If you think this wouldn't get the public's attention, you're crazy.
Fine, okay, I can't argue with you there. In any case, getting back to the peer review and rigorous validation of mathematical disease models, this would ensure that all models adhere to certain standards, and policymakers may feel more secure in relying on the outcomes generated by these models. You know, if the models were better evaluated.
I can't help but feel that advancing technologies would also have to play a key role here. Like you said, Aubrey, those fashion models would be carrying laptops.
Right you are, Dee. Increasing the utilization and availability of technologies, think of things like iPhones and Facebook, could provide important opportunities for the use and improvement of mathematical models in disease control.
For example, in Haiti, mobile phone data was used to predict the spread of cholera far more accurately than traditional projection methods. Now, the debaters didn't actually give us a year or time period they were talking about here, but given context clues, I'd predict they were referencing the 2010 outbreak. Many believe that existing technologies such as these haven't really been leveraged to their potential.
And there are also opportunities to incorporate technologies from other disciplines, things ranging from oil drilling all the way to hedge funds into infectious disease modeling.
But before we go talking up Twitter as disease predictor extraordinaire, let's clarify that technology may not have all of the solutions. While it does offer a lot of new opportunities, other data obstacles are still standing in our way, one of which includes problems accessing the physical data that could be most useful for developing the mathematical models themselves, largely due to privacy issues. While the inclusion of this sensitive data could improve the accuracy of these models, it could also infringe upon the privacy of individuals who are wishing to maintain their anonymity. I mean, we are talking about medical information here.
Which is always a tough subject, so moving on, it's time to discuss some economic concepts and their relationship to this issue of infectious disease spread.
Oh, I'm legitimately excited about this part.
You? Why? I feel like I'm the one who studies things most similar to economics.
It doesn't mean I can't be interested. We haven't really talked very much about economics on the forum before.
Well, before we get into it, and since you're right, we haven't really discussed economics on the show before, let's take a step back to orient everyone with the manner in which we're using the term economic.
That's really a good idea, because the presenter and debaters used economic in a broader sense than just matters of money. In the words of Dr. Fisman, economics here is referring more to a discipline that seeks to understand the behaviors and choices of individuals and societies as they attempt to maximize their well-being through the production and distribution of, quote, goods.
And these, quote, goods in question are the absence of morbidity and mortality from persistent infectious disease. Failure to incorporate these economic considerations into disease control policy will, in the end, result in suboptimal policy. So, with all that in mind, first up, we have the concept of Nash equilibria.
Okay, so picture this. A disease is nearly eradicated due to high vaccine coverage. You're getting vaccinated, your neighbors are getting vaccinated, everything's well. Suddenly, you hear some weird stuff online or on the radio about vaccinations, and you get just a tiny bit skeptical. You're not necessarily anti-vaccine, but you're also questioning whether or not you're going to vaccinate your child. At this point, living with modern medicine and all, it seems like this perceived risk associated with the vaccine itself outweighs the risk of infection and disease. After all, everyone else is getting vaccinated, so surely nothing will happen if you forego this vaccination with your child.
And with that, you have Nash equilibria. According to Dr. Fisman, this perception of certain risks outweighing others is pretty much inevitable. The concept of free riding is also associated with this. We're talking about, ignoring your own disease control and prevention because you're relying on the promise that those around you are taking the proper precautions to maintain the eradication of a disease. And this doesn't just occur at the individual level. It can actually occur within hospitals or even whole sections of society.
In other words, people are capitalizing on the herd immunity that is provided by the large number of people who do receive vaccinations.
There was strong agreement amongst the debaters that concepts such as Nash equilibria and free ridership are not taken into account sufficiently in infectious disease control strategies and policies.
And this is a major issue because these concepts may have negative implications for the effectiveness of certain intervention strategies, like vaccination.
Other factors we really need to take into consideration when responding to infectious disease, both at the individual and country level, include factors like culture and socioeconomic status.
Isn't there pretty broad knowledge and acceptance of this already, though?
There seems to be, yeah, but this hasn't necessarily translated into disease control strategies. Sociobehavioral responses to infectious disease risks have been largely underutilized as data for mathematical models. Not to mention that there's also the prevailing issue of a deficiency in a wider understanding about why variations in sociobehavioral responses exist in the first place.
And this also affects disease surveillance, which is an integral piece of the full infectious disease prevention picture, so to speak, which I know our listeners are all abundantly aware of, since I'm sure they all listened intently to episode 27 on disease surveillance.
Harry Potter and the Surveillance Heroes.
Such a good episode.
Go check it out, people.
I'm seriously loving all the past episode shoutouts today. Really, though, check back at some of our old stuff. Maybe we sound a little cringeworthy sometimes, but our information is on point.
Well, whether you've listened to episode 27 or not, just know that the debaters seem to agree that current surveillance techniques aren't properly taking into account enough sources of data.
They also believed that types of data, such as that information related to behavioral responses, are heavily underrepresented.
Within disease surveillance, reliance on limited sources, or worse, only one source of information, increases the likelihood of erroneous models.
Obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
As an example, we can look at Google Flu Trends. This was a modeling program that apparently had limited success when used in isolation of additional data, as it didn't take into account changes in behavior associated with disease threat, like the fact that I refuse to leave the germ-free security of my home when the kids I babysit come down with the flu.
Something else of significance that we should note is the strong link between a country's wealth and its health. With very few exceptions, there's a tight link between a country's level of wealth and health outcomes.
The issue is that there's an abundance of complex factors impacting this association, and it's pretty difficult to determine causality from any one factor. Whether wealth translates to health or health translates to wealth, God, why did you guys make me say that? Well, it's an important distinction to know because it has implications for policy decisions.
What's interesting, though, is to consider the resurgence of a number of preventable diseases, like pertussis and measles, in more wealthy countries due to people being more likely to refuse vaccines. The very economic status of the country has in some ways mandated incorporating things like free ridership and herd immunity into infectious disease control strategies.
So the debaters mapped out a few things we need to consider and steps that should be taken as we move forward with developing better modes of tracking, understanding, and preventing infectious disease spread.
First off, there was a call for mathematical models being employed by researchers and policymakers in a variety of fields so that the models aren't solely in the domain of a narrow group of mathematically centered individuals. You know, so people not like Cleo.
Thanks for that.
Anytime.
And this can be achieved in part by training individuals to understand the development and application of models as tools for infectious disease control.
Given the acknowledged importance of training researchers and policymakers to appropriately create and interpret models, public health degree programs could include courses on models as part of the curricula.
Informal educational programs must also be developed that would allow those already working in public health to, you know, go back and learn how to appropriately apply modeling to their current activities.
Messaging is also a hugely important topic here, both in terms of communicating the value and limitations of models, as well as for increasing vaccine uptake. The debaters actually laid out three key messaging messages for us, for lack of better terms.
The first is that non-mathematicians can and should be trained to better use models.
The second is that carefully constructed models can be successfully used to manage disease risk.
And the third is that models can be effective tools for communicating with lay audiences when the outcomes are made plain.
Especially with this topic of vaccines, it appears that the public looks for credible messengers to guide them, and no one has provided them with the intellectual tools to make proper decisions about vaccine use. And in countries like the US and Canada, where people are often guided by a credo of rugged individualism, it might be especially impossible to get people to understand the importance, concepts, and values underlying collective group action, and thus preventing things like free ridership.
And mandating rigorous policies may definitely help with disease control, but things like social changes, we're talking old school attitude adjustments here, that are related to protecting the common good may actually be more effective. I mean, think about it. Mandatory vaccinations work, sure, but a more sustainable approach might be educating and changing mindsets, all so that we have both disease control and, you know, the preservation of individual liberties.
Because one of the last things policymakers should want to do is infringe upon the decision-making rights of individuals.
I feel like we just threw a lot at everyone right there. I mean, mathematics, vaccines, runway walks, herd immunity.
So let's begin wrapping up this episode.
That means it's time for our usual question session. So do you think all this effort should be devoted to improving mathematical modeling? Is it realistic to expect non-experts to ever use them?
How can we work toward ensuring that preventable diseases actually remain prevented? Is requiring mandatory vaccinations too extreme?
Let us know if and how this episode helped you conceptualize infectious disease control a little better.
We look forward to hearing your thoughts, so make sure you hit us up on Twitter at ISGB Forum or by searching ISGB's The Forum on Facebook.
Thanks for socializing with science today, guys. We'll talk to you again soon, so see you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.